4:30 here on a Wednesday afternoon, back on Downtown. Rich Kimble, Bruce Pratt, and it's time for this week's Sports Lit 101, a book that we've talked about a couple of times on the program. Such a wonderful read, and so excited to talk with the man behind it. The book is entitled Schoolboy, The Untold Journey of a Yankees Hero. Tim Manor is the editor and, compiler of this fascinating story, joins us. Tim, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Rich. Great to be here.
The book is so great, and it's such a fascinating look at not just baseball, but at a time in our nation's history. Can you tell the backstory of how Waite Hoyt's writings came into your possession?
Yeah, the backstory is almost as interesting as the story itself. It's all because one of Waite's sons, Chris, Chris Hoyt, is a friend of mine. I've known him for about 40 years. And I actually had known Chris for a couple of years before he even mentioned who his famous father was. We were kind of in business together. I was in the PR business. Chris was my client. We were coming back from a meeting in New York City. And I think Chris was just bored and trying to make conversation. And he said, my dad was the Hall of Fame pitcher for the 1927 New York Yankees, which, of course, that got my attention. And I sat up straight and I said, really? What was his name? And he said, Waite Hoyt. And I said, who? What? Wait, because I had never heard of him, and I was really embarrassed, especially after I learned about the amazing career that Waite had had, particularly as a baseball player, and later on as the voice of the Cincinnati Reds. It just was astonishing to me and somewhat mortifying that I had never heard of him before. But that led to the book, ultimately, some 40 years later. I've known Chris since 1984. I was out at his house in Arizona, and the subject of his dad and the fact that his father had never written a memoir had come up from time to time, and it came up yet again. And Chris just looked at me and said, you know, I have 8 boxes of his files, and I am sending them to you. And so the next thing I knew, I had Waite Hoyt's papers, memoir attempts, notes, interview transcripts, newspaper clippings, you name it. It was all in there. I was sitting on my front doorstep and started to go through those boxes. And as luck would have it, there was this thick 3-ring binder that had hundreds of pages of interview transcripts that Waite had done shortly before he died. I think about 2 years before he had passed away. His niece, Ellen, who is Chris's cousin, had it in mind that she was going to write a biography, never did, but all these transcripts were left behind. I took a look through that and I realized pretty quickly that there was an opportunity here to do something really special, which was not a biography of Waite Hoyt, but a true memoir written entirely in his own words.
Well, and what was your reaction when you began to read his words? Because this is not your typical athlete memoir, because of his wonderful capacity to capture things so eloquently.
Well, so it was... It's really a multi-layered book. I mean, it started out, it was just the story of a baseball player, but there definitely were different levels of ideas going on. Waite was very clear in his notes, because I had not only access to these transcripts and various memoir attempts, he had made something like 5 different attempts to write a memoir. I had all that, but I had his notes where he indicated pretty clearly that he didn't want this just to be a series of amusing anecdotes about a baseball player. He wanted it to also capture the era, the Roaring Twenties and so forth, and beyond that a bit as well, but also himself as a man and what he saw as his internal conflicts. And he had a suitcase full of internal conflicts. He was a highly conflicted guy, and I think that's really what makes the story so compelling in so many ways.
Well, I think the other thing that makes it compelling is when you think about some pitcher who can pitch that long, you think of the kid that came out of the farm somewhere, the big, tough kid from Nebraska who, you know, was throwing hay bales. This is a kid from Brooklyn who is pitching batting practice for the Giants, New York Giants, when he's 15. I mean, his early life story just doesn't fit the mold you see of so many biographies. And do you think that led to a lot of the conflicts?
Well, I think it did. So he was in Brooklyn, which, when you think about it, actually was kind of the Mesopotamia of modern-day baseball. He grew up in the shadow of Ebbets Field, being built not far from the Polo Grounds, which is why it was possible for someone as young as he was to pitch batting practice for actually both the Dodgers initially and then later the Giants. But the conflict, I think, it goes right to his upbringing. He had a father who was a baseball nut, who was a pretty good baseball player himself, also a vaudevillian, which was the path that Wade followed later in his career. His mother is quite the opposite. She was a writer. She was very intellectual. She was all about what was proper and respectable. She wanted nothing more than for her son to go to college and get a real job, whereas his dad was very interested in his son becoming a famous baseball star. And, of course, Wade found that path irresistible. So his story is, I agree with you, Bruce, I think his story is unconventional, which is surprising. And I actually feel that the book is just one surprising story after another.
And he had a brief career as a mortician, or at least working in the funeral business, had a body in the trunk of his car while he pitched a game before he'd get it to the funeral home. I mean, this is a man who did more different kinds of things than I can think of any other professional athlete. Sure, some of them become actors, some of them have done this, that, or that, but he did whatever he needed to do to keep his world running, and I find that incredibly laudable.
Well, it's laudable, it's enviable, too. I mean, he's the kind of guy who you almost hate because he was good at everything he tried. Yeah. Any sport he tried, he excelled at. He was very successful on vaudeville. His career as a mortician didn't exactly work out. But, of course, later on, he became the voice of the Reds, and he really played a pioneering role there as well. He was one of the very first former athletes to make the transition to the announcer's booth. Before that, it was generally believed that athletes were too dumb and inarticulate. Of course, he was anything but that. And he really paved the way for a lot of careers of former ballplayers.
Well, it's amazing, too, that he even got the opportunity, the story of what happened to him as a youngster when he nearly lost his hands was incredibly harrowing.
It was, and it was interesting, by the way, as I read it, it was just so unbelievable. And I asked Chris, his son, about it. He had never heard anything about it, which is just amazing. You would think that would be something his dad would kind of mention, that I almost had both my hands amputated before I became one of the greatest pitchers in baseball history. But apparently it never came up. But yeah, I mean, his story, as I said, is just one amazing anecdote or instance or happenstance after another, and it's truly an odyssey.
And he's associated with the names we associate with the great eras of baseball. In the 20s, certainly. I mean, he's just say you get Cobb and Ruth and Gehrig and all these people. And then later, he's broadcasting. When was the last year he stopped? I mean, he broadcast the Reds at a time when the Reds had some of the most legendary players of their era. I mean, this is a guy that really, really, his career spans a long, long time.
It does. And one thing that I found in his notes is that he very much wanted a chapter that compared the early days of baseball when he was playing to the modern era, at least at that time, which was the early 60s. So he ended his radio broadcasting career in 1965. He did make a brief television comeback in the early 70s, but he made very close connections with many of the members of the Big Red Machine, people like Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, Joe Morgan. They were all great friends of his, particularly Pete Rose. They were very close. I think that Pete, I mean, I've heard, I don't know this for a fact, but members of the Hoyt family told me that Wade was kind of almost a father figure to Pete. Of course, All the mischief that Pete got into happened later on, well after Wade had passed. So that wasn't anything that Wade was ever aware of. We could conjecture that maybe had Wade lived, that might not have happened. Who knows? But you're right. I mean, it's just to have been a close friend of Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and so forth, and knowing people like Ty Cobb and Rogers Hornsby, although not particularly close to them or even liking them very much. He was, you know, his life had almost a zealot quality to it. It wasn't just the baseball players, but it was also Al Capone and J. Edgar Hoover. And because of his vaudeville career, Mae West, the Marx Brothers, Jimmy Durante, he crossed paths with all of them.
We're talking with Tim Manners about the new book, Schoolboy, The Untold Story of a Yankees Hero. And you mentioned the amazing history that he lived through. And certainly when you think about the 20s and the roaring 20s, you can picture it, or you can hear and Reed Waite describe it, because he was certainly somebody who rolled up their sleeves and got right into everything that was going on, and even talked about how it took its toll physically on him.
Well, it did. I mean, it didn't help his conditioning as an athlete, and that was a point of contention between Waite and the Yankees. Miller Huggins and Ed Barrow, Huggins being the manager, Barrow the general manager of the Yankees, were desperate for Waite to stop playing vaudeville during the offseason because he'd show up for spring training terribly out of condition. But the issue was that Waite was making three times as much money on vaudeville. He was playing the biggest houses all across the country, and people just flocked to see the Yankee stars sing and dance. And it was really it was so lucrative for him that he couldn't give it up.
I love his description. He says, I got to drinking again. I know it sounds as if I was a chronic drinker or an alcoholic, but I was not, absolutely not. I drank about as much as anybody did during the halcyon days of the 20s. Because of Prohibition, liquor wasn't readily available, so when it was around, we sometimes drank too much because we never knew when we were going to get another drink.
Right, right. Poor fella. Well, anyway, so he said also in the book that he never pitched under the influence, which I think is probably true. He didn't realize he had a drinking problem, apparently, until after he had left baseball and started his second career as an announcer for the Reds. He knew he had been drinking, but it wasn't until later on, around 1945, and he describes bottoming out on alcohol in almost harrowing detail, where he just disappeared from his job as the announcer of the Reds for 3 days, holed up in the Netherlands Plaza Hotel in downtown Cincinnati, drinking. He finally makes his way to the seedy Cincinnati bar, has a final shot of whiskey, and then wanders out to the sidewalk, finds a payphone, calls a local hospital, and checks himself in. He never had another drop of alcohol after that. He joined Alcoholics Anonymous and became a sponsor of other alcoholics and those with addiction problems, and a spokesman, made many, many speeches on alcoholism. But he said he didn't even know what it was to be an alcoholic until he found himself in that fix. The interesting dynamic in that whole story is that his sponsor, when he was the announcer for the Reds, was the Burger Beer Company. And he thought for sure, Waite did, that he was going to be fired, because how could he possibly reconcile promoting beer on the air at the same time preaching about the evils of alcohol? But the Burger Beer Company stood by him, which was really incredible when you think about it. This is 1945. That's a pretty progressive outlook to have. And also the people of Cincinnati rallied around him. Up until that point, there was sort of a general feeling that Waite was just passing through Cincinnati on his way back to New York, which, if he was being honest, he'd probably admit that was true. He really wanted to be announcer for the Yankees, not the Reds at that time. But there was such a rally around him through that experience. It completely changed his outlook, and he decided to make Cincinnati his permanent home. In fact, he's buried in Cincinnati at the famous Spring Grove Cemetery.
One of the things that I found really interesting in the book was that his honesty about the way he felt about other players. Not that he was throwing people under the bus necessarily, but if he didn't think someone was a really good guy, he mentioned it. He didn't go to great extent. And he played with some guys that were known as being pretty miserable as a rule by others. Do you think that was in part because he was thinking about the memoir, that he was thinking that he would write a book, or do you think it was just the way he was, that he just straight up tell you what it was and not add anything?
I think that's just the way he was. And I knowing his son Chris, who's exactly the same way, and by the way, that was one of the kicks of doing this the way that I did it, is that Waite's speech patterns and Chris, my friend's speech patterns, are almost identical. So when I was reading what Waite was saying, I could hear my friend Chris talking. But he was just a straight up guy. And he would temper it, though, if you notice, Bruce. For example, with Ty Cobb, he didn't hold back in terms of how he felt about Ty Cobb. But at the same time, he was careful or very precise in also balancing it out by talking about how much he admired him as a baseball player. Same thing with Rogers Hornsby. He just didn't like Hornsby at all. but he complimented him. How could you not? I mean, he was a great player, even if he wasn't the greatest human being.
And of course, one of the most memorable moments of his broadcasting career was the day that Babe Ruth died, when he happened to be on the air and delivered this incredibly memorable recollection of Babe that went on for what, more than an hour?
Yeah, it was at least an hour. And actually, the anniversary was just a few days ago. August 16th, 1948 was the date, and Waite was on the air when Babe passed, came over the teletype. And he just told his listeners, that if you'd like, just hang out after the game and we'll just talk to Babe. And he held forth really just incredibly eloquently. It was a eulogy, in effect, a number of stories about Babe Ruth, one after another. You can find it online on YouTube. It's definitely worth checking out. Just an epic display of Waite's intelligence and his ability as a master storyteller. He was just incredible.
I listened to it about a month ago, maybe a little less than a month ago. I was unfortunately not able to listen, like, concentrated. I had it on. But what struck me is that wouldn't happen today. You know, they wouldn't give you that hour. And I think that the magic of radio, and this is, Rich and I love radio, the magic of radio in that day was that people could do things like that. I mean, I can remember the Yankees, listening to the Yankees as a kid, and the game ran a little long, and there was just, you know, there was another beer commercial or whatever, and Mel Allen may have had another one in between, but there was no rush to get done, you know. And I think that we need more announcers like that, and fewer announcers that want to tell us that it was a 51 mile an hour changeup that fell short. You know, tell us the whole game, the game we love.
Yeah, that was really the magic of Waite Hoyt, that ability that he had to fit in these stories in quiet moments during a game. To listen, it's just really incredible how he did that, where he would time his little anecdote just so it would run right up to the moment when the action would start again. Of course, he was famous and beloved, and to this day, he has a huge following and fan club still alive and kicking in Cincinnati. They were very young when he was on the air, but they remember him for those rain delays. He's famous for filling the airtime during rain delays, because the deal with Burger Beer Company is they were going to stay on the air through any kind of delay at all. Waite was just the perfect guy to handle an assignment like that, because he had this deep reservoir of stories about not only Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, but just about anybody you could name from his heyday as the ace pitcher of the 1920s, the whole decade, the 1920s Yankees.
It reminded me when I was reading the book, we had the author's name's going to jump out of my head here, a perfect eloquence about Vin Scully and how Scully was able to do that. You know, I think that for the Hoyt being able to do it so well, that he was able to do something the other guys couldn't do, because he'd actually played the game. He played it at the highest level. He won, what, 3 World Series with the Yankees at a time with arguably the best team perhaps ever in Major League Baseball. I know there are a million arguments about that, and no need to get into it. But he was really one of the very best of the very best. And then he went on and did all these other things. And I can't think of another baseball player that ever did that as well.
Well, I think his career truly was unique. He writes a little bit about that, how his experience in baseball was different even from somebody as colorful as Babe Ruth. He wasn't claiming that he was as colorful as Babe Ruth, but he experienced things, particularly in the minor leagues, that other players like Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Ty Cobb never had to go through. And he, on top of that, he was only this 15, 16, 17 year old kid. And he was in hard gravel places like Lebanon, Pennsylvania, playing with men twice his age and everything that comes with that, the drinking, the gambling, the houses of ill repute. It really was not a great place at all, to put it lightly, for a young man to find himself. And it kind of blows my mind that his mother permitted this to happen, given who she was. But ultimately, it was his father who held sway, and the rest is history.
Well, and it is a fabulous book. I wish we had more time. I could talk about this with you all day, but I hope that everybody listening, you'll go out and find Schoolboy, The Untold Journey of a Yankees Hero, Wade Hoyt with Tim Manners. The forwards by Bob Costas, George F. Will blurbs it well. It's from our friends at the University of Nebraska Press, who we love dearly. And I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us today, Tim.
Well, thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Well, we'll have to talk again sometime.
Absolutely. Anytime.
That's Tim Manners. And again, such a wonderful book, Schoolboy, The Untold Story of a Yankee Hero. We'll take a break and back to close out Hour 1 on a Wednesday afternoon.
We go out in stormy weather. We rarely practice discern. We make love to some weird sin. We seek out.